Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm going to be speaking today with psychiatrist and author Robert J. Lifton about his latest book, Losing Reality, about the dangerous brew of political and religious zealotry, both embodied and exploited by Donald Trump. You can learn more at robertjlifton.com. That's Robert J, J-A-Y, Lifton, L-I-F-T-O-N, robertjlifton.com. The show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. There are 132 days until Election Day. I encourage you to get involved, not only with candidate campaigns, but also with efforts to fight voter suppression and assure that all Americans get their right to vote. This is even more challenging, of course, in this time of pandemic. Make sure that all Americans can vote by mail and learn about the need to fund the U.S. Postal Service hit hard by the loss of business mail. We'll talk probably a bit more about the campaign and its meaning with today's guest. As we confront the coronavirus pandemic, I encourage you also to do your part by social distancing, wearing a mask in public, and so on, and by finding ways to help those in your community who have been hurt most by the social isolation and the economic devastation now unfolding. Finally, as we continue to make our voices heard against racism and police brutality and for justice and inclusion, please do your part to keep this campaign alive, whether it's showing up on the streets or helping with organizing or fundraising or just taking on the deep reflection or habit building in your personal life and with those closest to you. Now to today's conversation. Today is Tuesday, June 23rd. We face the worst health news since the influenza of 1918. 2.25 million, 2.25 million coronavirus cases in the U.S., over 120,000 deaths. Following an overall decrease in daily incidents from mid-April through the end of May, our national COVID-19 burden has been increasing since early June. We face some of the worst economic news since the Depression. U.S. weekly jobless claims hit 1.5 million last week, bringing the 13-week total to 46 million. More than one in four American workers have lost a job during the pandemic. It's also more than the roughly 37 million people who filed unemployment insurance claims during the year and a half of the Great Recession a decade ago. Perhaps the greatest wealth disparities in our nation's history. In the first 12 weeks that people in the U.S. began sheltering in place, U.S. billionaire wealth increased by more than $637 billion. There are, in fact, 16 more billionaires in the U.S. than there were 2 months ago. Finally, in response to the police killing of George Floyd, we may be experiencing the largest, longest mass demonstrations in our history. People have held protests in all 50 states and our nation's capital, including in hundreds of smaller towns and cities. This past weekend marked nearly 4 weeks of actions. The United States usually has big protests or sustained protests, but seldom both. And lurking behind all of this, climate change threatens us all. As with the pandemic, we share vulnerability. We share fate. Will we choose to emerge from this global slowdown with a plan and some principles to reshape how we deal with energy, consumption, growth, or will we waste the opportunity full speed ahead to the past? And it's an election year, with authoritarianism and the rule of law on the ballot. During a pandemic, with the full powers of government in the White House, the Senate, and many state houses actively suppressing the vote, on equipment that fails way too routinely and is often hackable, and with at least three foreign governments having been asked to intervene in Trump's behalf. In this moment, events echo the Gilded Age of the turn of the 20th century, the influenza of 1918-19, the depression of the 1930s, the protest movements of the 1960s, and it can be said without hyperbole, we face the most critical election in our lifetimes. That is our reality. Or is it? For perspective, I turn today to Robert J. Lifton, psychiatrist, author, and founding member of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1986. Lifton has spent a lifetime not turning away from our dark side. He's written about survivors in Hiroshima of the first nuclear bomb, about Nazi doctors in Hitler's Germany, Vietnam veterans, the Japanese cult that released sarin gas on its own people. Lifton is now 93, and he can find the darkness closer to home. He wrote the foreword to The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Experts Assess a President. And his latest book is Losing Reality on Cults, Cultism, and the Mindset of Political and Religious Zealotry. Those crises and calamities I listed a minute ago, I declared them our reality. But despite the fact that my words consisted almost entirely of reputable data, that reality is not shared by everyone. We no longer agree, not just about the solutions to our problems, but about their simple facts. How did this happen? How long has it been going on? How does Trump fit into this narrative? And does Robert have any reasons for hope? Welcome again, Robert J. Lifton, to Freeform, A World That Just Might Work. Let me remind listeners, we're recording this conversation Tuesday, June 23rd.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
Very good. First of all, how are you doing? Where do you live? What's the pandemic like? How are you coping with the chaos and the isolation?
Well, for many years, I've lived two places, in New York City and in Wellfleet, Massachusetts on Cape Cod, and divided them by 6 months or 7 months in one and five in the other. Now I've moved from New York City, my apartment, to my home in Wellfleet, where I am and where I'm working and functioning quite well, but recognize that no place, whether it's Wellfleet or some large city or isolated area, no place is totally safe given the nature and the contagious quality of this COVID-19 epidemic.
Okay. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So it's almost a bit absurd, given not just the length of your life, but the range of work and ideas you've undertaken. But briefly, how do you see your path to the work you're doing these days? And you can go way back, especially turning points, moments of decision. What's the through line, the narrative that gets us to today?
It's hard to, maybe I can give you a moment that I wrote about in my memoir. When I was walking the streets of Hong Kong, wondering whether to return home because I was due to resume my career there or to stay in Hong Kong and get some sort of research grant to study something I'd become enormously fascinated by. And I walked and walked around and made a decision to stay. And at that moment, way back in the 1950s, at that moment, my subsequent future was determined to be a psychiatrist in the world rather than somebody opening his office to see individual patients. And from then on, I took on a sense of myself. I identified myself as one who did these studies that involved psychology and history. And that sequence, with a focus on destructive historical events, always looked on by me psychologically and historically, that sequence became the story of my professional life, and it still is. And I'm now drawing upon things I've studied over the course of that work, and you mentioned a number of them, to shed some light on what's happening in our society now and shed some light on the dangers we face.
Yes, I, as I was going through, you know, your work over the years and so on, that's what led me to that one line where I said, you know, you now can find the darkness closer to home. You know, it was off to China, off to Japan, you know, but we've got it now happening right in front of us.
Yes, well, my work always went back and forth between destructive behavior in far-off places, like my study of Hiroshima survivors in Hiroshima, and my work in Germany on Nazi doctors. But I also had done, fairly early on in my work, a study of anti-war veterans. And in that sense, I was aware of and focused on destructive behavior in my own society. Now I talk about what I call malignant normality, which is really imposing on a society as expectable and normal, egregious and destructive and sometimes murderous behavior. And I came to that idea from my study of Nazi doctors when I noted that the doctors who stood at the ramp and selected Jews for the gas chamber were just doing their job, doing what was expected of them. Some had difficulty doing it, and that's another story, but by and large, that was their norm. That was supposed to be their routine in that society. Then with the present Trump administration, not only Trump, but his relationship to destructive forces in the society, which have long predated him, we have a problematic malignant normality in our own society. And it really has to do with lying and cheating and admiring and embracing dictators while renouncing friends and theories with friends and other necessary domestic issues that are interfered with or destroyed by this dangerous president.
Yeah, one of the things that's occurred to me over these last 3 years is that, and I'm gonna set both my thought and then put it in slightly larger context, is that we have the Electoral College put in the presidency someone who is destructive of relationship, of human relationship at almost every level, whether it is breaking an alliance with our allies in Europe, breaking the Iran nuclear deal, jumping out of the Paris Accords, or separating children from their parents, or his every speech and utterance being to divide us rather than bring us together, at a time when relationships have never been more critical. The biggest challenges we face, at least some of which are existential, global pandemics, climate change, nuclear weapons, technological disruption, inequality, racism, all call for cooperation, some on a global scale, yet we seem on a global scale to be moving away from that. And then we see this malignant manifestation in the U.S. Your thoughts?
Well, I look upon Trump's behavior as what I call solipsistic reality. And what I mean very simply is self-created reality, reality that is determined only by the self and its experience and its needs, and can ignore larger claims to reality on the part of very huge numbers of people, and can also ignore traditional standards of evidence. And this grandiose, solipsistic reality is associated with what I also speak of as a grandiose paranoia, a sense that I alone, Trump alone, can fix the harm, the world as it has been hurt by prior presidents and prior leaders who lacked his capacity for exerting power and making deals. That being the case, his combination of solipsistic reality and a kind of grandiose paranoia renders him profoundly dangerous in every single manifestation of his behavior as president. And we're seeing that in relation to climate, in relationship to the nature of reality in general, and in relationship to the uprisings now, which are about racism, but extend to really the problem of oppression in general. And in that sense, in my recent work, I've put a lot of emphasis upon reality, what it is, and how it's violated, and the dangers of that.
Yeah, I know we're going to jump around during this conversation, just because there's so much that you've dealt with, so much that's going on. That's sort of why I listed all those different sort of highlights or lowlights at the start. But one of the things that has struck me is that the pandemic, in a way, almost more than anything else I've seen in my lifetime, carries the message that we all share a vulnerability, that we all share a fate. And I wonder if you see that experience as a precursor to us responding to the death of George Floyd in a more related way than we might have.
Yes, very much so. They are related. One way of looking at our response to the COVID-19 virus is that it is an organic physical matter. People get sick and they die. And as much as Trump or others might try to cover up deaths and illnesses, they're vivid, they're there. And there are various authorities on epidemiology and public health who can receive them and comment on them and interpret their nature and their danger. So Trump's solipsistic reality, self-created reality, can no longer hold. It never held absolutely, but when you dealt with more abstract reality, such as his call to the president of Ukraine and what they said and what that meant, or even his rejection of the Mueller report, one could sustain in Trump's situation an alternate narrative, a false narrative, but that could have some kernel of truth or could be believable or at least could fit in with Trump's overall narrative of restoring America's greatness. But when it comes to the physicality, the medical nature, the deaths, the death-centered nature of the virus, you can't do that. And Trump has not had a complete psychological breakdown, but he has had a reality breakdown. And that's why this is a turning point. He is now in definite difficulty and full of contradictions, so that his lies and exaggerations become more extreme, and there's a vicious circle going on in which that extremity in what he says and does is more and more resisted, which brings about his anxiety and more extremity. And that's the kind of situation we're in. It's a hopeful situation in that it could be a kind of end game for him, but it's also a very dangerous situation in which he could do extreme things, as he's been doing right along, ever more extreme in harming the country and the world.
Right. In other words, the sort of cornered animal kind of metaphor, right?
Yes, very much so.
He can go beyond even his past recklessness in desperation.
He can. And since there's a strange quality to Trump that's unusual, in which he has both this extreme expression of solipsistic or self-created reality on the one hand, but also has a certain talent for manipulating the media and a certain political savvy on the other hand. He has had a balance between them. Now I think the balance is broken. He's more and more desperate. And even the strange rally and its failure on Saturday really evoked his difficulty. It did that because there were predicted and expected 19 or 20,000 people in the arena, and anywhere from 50 to 100,000 people who were there but couldn't get in and would create their own herd reality. He got instead a total of 6,200 people at most. He was calling for a kind of martyrdom on the part of his people. They should come and risk illness. They needn't wear masks, and they certainly shouldn't practice and couldn't practice social distancing. And it reminded me of an extreme association of Jim Jones, who carried through what was called revolutionary suicide in 1978, in which more than 950 people were killed. In fact, more of them murdered than actual suicide. What differed in Trump's case is that he not only had a version of revolutionary suicide, but he also had them sign away their legal rights to sue or take any action against him should he should they become in any way sick. So it was revolutionary suicide with a waiver. It turns out that a lot of them didn't show up, and perhaps one reason, there are many reasons, but perhaps one important reason is many of them didn't want to be martyred in this way. And in some sense, by staying away, question their guru. And that's very significant, because when I've studied cults, such as Aum Shinrikyo, the Japanese fanatical cult, which deposited sarin gas in Tokyo subway trains, as you mentioned, in 1995, once their guru, who had been absolute, had been, so to speak, de-guruized, had been arrested, revealed as a criminal, put in prison, some of his most intense and previously loyal survivors turned against him bitterly and attacked him as a false guru and an evil human being. When intense disciples find that their guru can no longer offer them what they need, the meaning in their lives, the energy in their lives, they may turn upon him in a particularly intense manner, and with at least some of Trump's disciples, by no means all of them, and by no means even a majority of them, but at least some of them, and that's very significant, have had that kind of experience, in my judgment.
Yeah, and by the way, you pointed out how the pandemic, because it is a physical, it's a physical, tangible, not an abstract, nothing you can shape just by talking about it. In a way, the visual of that auditorium, of that arena, is the same sort of thing.
Yes, yes, and you mentioned the relationship between the response to COVID-19 and now the uprisings about racism. And you notice that the uprisings really began with a videotape.
Yep.
A very concrete visual demonstration of a policeman murdering a black man. And that was the basis, again, that physical reality, and the demand for acceptance of that reality, of that event, and of systemic racism in general, and then more generally, of oppression in general. Again, that physicality. Mm-hmm. And of course, the same minority groups, and especially blacks, but also Hispanics and others, who suffered and are suffering most from COVID-19 virus, are also the victims of police brutality. And of course they make, and we must make, and are increasingly making, this association. And even if you invoke climate change, which is an ultimate reality that subsumes and contains all else, again, minorities and very poor people are victimized at least first and most so far in the process of climate change. All of these have at their center a struggle for reality, and that's where psychological professionals like myself can come in. There is otherwise a political process that has to be managed by others, but there is there are psychological tendencies that I think are very useful for the society and for the political leaders to understand.
Yeah, I wonder. You know, the fact that the pandemic and the virus have hit people of poverty and color very disproportionately. Those numbers had been out there, but I suspect that they would not have had the feeling of reality that they have taken on had it not been for the George Floyd murder.
Yes, that's right. And it's interesting that some of the thoughtful commentators invoke James Baldwin now. And Baldwin's whole message was, you've got to face the reality of the history of black people in America, a history that is also present, the present reality. And the actuality, the reality, was absolutely central to everything he said so poetically. And he becomes, retrospectively, one of the heroic figures in this process.
I want to spend just a couple of minutes on the climate swerve. We've talked about climate change a couple of times here. You wrote an essay in the New York Times with that title, Climate Swerve, in 2014, and a book in 2017. What do you mean by a swerve, and why do you think it might be happening?
Well, when I wrote The Climate Swerve, I was taking note of the fact, and this is a modestly hopeful dimension, taking note of the fact that Americans very quickly, according to many polls and studies, shifted from climate denial on a large scale or rejection to a recognition of climate change and the factors, the carbon released into the environment by fossil fuels as a major source of climate change, and also the direction of necessary and wise policies. And I use the word swerve because that was used in earlier ways. It began with Lucretius, and it really had to do with a shift, in the case of Lucretius, of particles, but in more commentators, a shift in worldview on a collective scale that large numbers of people underwent, sometimes suddenly and without clear reason, or at least without a clear sequence. And that's what seems to have happened. So I called it a climate swerve, from denial and rejection on the one hand to recognition and a mindset that was ready to take necessary steps. Unfortunately, the other side of it, which is more grievous and more dangerous, has to do with the inability so far to take those necessary steps, and the rapidity, the greater rate of climate change that scientists are recognizing as compared to what they had thought to be the rate of climate change before. So it's both, on the one hand, a dire situation, but with a measure of hope from the climate swerve that I speak about in that book.
And it seems to me, again, and it's interesting, because I think had we had this conversation 3 months ago, we'd have been talking, bear with me here for a second, about reality in a more abstract way. That what we keep coming back to is reality in a very real, concrete way, whether it's, you know, virus,
yes, and
murder, arena, empty seats. And in this case, I think one thing you've pointed out is that you think, although unpredictable, that one of the things you think is a contributing factor is the wildfires, the droughts, the disasters.
Yes. So I've come in my work to look at reality and see how acutely that is connected to our struggles. In general, this is a good time to talk about what one means by reality.
Very good.
There is the larger abstract reality that all societies have and their leaders promulgated. And, you know, it has to do in our society with questions, is democracy the best form of government or is it not? Or is there a God or is there not a God? And that's abstract reality. But there's also an immediate factual reality. You and I are having a discussion now for a podcast on work that I do and that you promote and participate in, and we're talking about such things as climate change and the danger of the virus and the uprisings about racism. Now, it's one thing for a president or anyone to play around with the larger abstract reality. All presidents do. But when a president or any leading figure starts denying factual, immediate, physical reality, both he or she and the nation are in deep trouble. And when Trump tries to deny that factual reality, especially in more organic and physical situations such as the virus and such as the killing and the video of the killing of black victims by policemen, we are having a denial of factual reality that is no longer tolerated by the society. And the uprisings are hopeful in their insistence that we reject this unreality, this false reality, this alternate reality, or this tendency on the part of the Trump administration toward what I call malignant normality. And that's one way of looking at what these uprisings are about.
Yep. Let me tell people, by the way, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally, speaking with psychiatrist and author Robert J. Lifton about his latest book is sort of the jumping off point. His latest book, Losing Reality, which is about the dangerous brew of political and religious zealotry, both embodied and exploited by Donald Trump. You can learn more about his work, and it's a long lifetime of work, over 20 books, plus several edited and so on, and you can learn more at robertjlifton.com. Robert J, J-A-Y, Lifton, L-I-F-T-O-N, all one word, robertjlifton.com. You know, one sentence that in your writing about reality that really was so succinct for me is you say we require a shared sense of reality consistent with experience and evidence. So that's sort of both of our realities, right? That one that we sort of experience and that one that there's evidence for. We require a shared sense of reality consistent with experience and evidence for our collective function in a democracy. So that's what's really in play here, isn't it?
Yes, very much so. What's relevant here is the attack by Trump and followers on our institutions, democratic institutions, which have always been flawed and never what they were claiming to be, but nonetheless functioning and depending upon a relationship to factual reality. And I call this an American version of Gleichschaltung. Gleichschaltung was a Nazi process by which they didn't destroy institutions. They never destroyed the medical institution. They simply relieved anyone who was not a reliable Nazi of leadership, and in many cases prosecuted them and got rid of them, and replaced them gradually or immediately with Nazi sympathizers, so that the various institutions were not so much destroyed as Nazified. And that's what Trump is doing. He's attacking the people who led with some integrity, all of our institutions, integrity depending upon a relationship to reality, a relationship to factual and immediate reality, and a concern for the well-being of the American people, replaced them with his own people in whom he requires not knowledge, because nobody appointed to head an institution by Trump has knowledge of that subject, but rather has ostensibly a certain amount of loyalty, which is his only criterion. And in that way, he has systematically come close to breaking down our democratic process, really undermining it. And we're still in some danger of that happening. In opposition to that have been movements and expressions that insist upon the truth of factual reality. And in that sense, the whole impeachment process and the whole Mueller study had to do with issues of reality as well as with political violations that were worthy of impeachment. The impeachment process was an effort to regain reality on the part of the nation. And that battle, in a way, was lost when the Senate rejected reality by rejecting a trial or rejecting witnesses and just made an automatic acquittal. But that process is ongoing. It's by no means over. And since the time of the Senate's egregious treatment of the matter, there have been these events, particularly the COVID-19 virus and now the uprisings, that have been a resurgence of reality and the demand for it. And that's why one can have some hope in the American future.
You know, it's interesting, Robert. The key point in the impeachment trial, I think, for me and I think for most, was whether to allow witnesses, whether to allow evidence. And what we've been saying is that, obviously, we are witnesses to the suffering of the pandemic. I think one of the unique things, as you pointed out, in terms of the video was, I would be pretty certain that never have as many millions of people actually witnessed a murder. A lot of people probably had never witnessed someone die.
Yes.
And to see someone die while someone else is looking confidently and blithely right at you. And then, when we saw the protest broken up by the tear gas, the horses, the batons for the photo op, we again witnessed. So there, the Republican Senate said no witnesses, but we are witnesses.
Yes, that's right. And what do we witness but physical reality, the actual killing, as we're both saying, of a black victim by a policeman. And before that, with the COVID-19 virus, when you have illness and the physicality of illness and death, the American people tend to turn away from political leaders and turn toward doctors and scientists, because each of us everywhere has some fear that the virus will reach us. Nobody is entirely safe from it, and we sense this. And that is another reason why more Americans have turned to the reputable epidemiologists than have turned to Trump or believed his versions of it. And that is a very significant step for the society and for Trump in what I believe can be the beginning of his end game.
Yeah. And if, I mean, it seems to me we have, again, when I said this conversation would have been very different 3 months ago, we'd have been talking about some of the same things, but it would have been very different. We have shifted within the course of this to the hopeful signs of indisputable witnessing and indisputable evidence and the effect that can have. And my guess is, just as both of us do not believe that Trump is the cause but is a symptom, he took advantage of a culture and sort of a state of vulnerability of millions of people. But just as he is not the cause, he is not the end either. And I guess we both probably hope that this movement toward truth will extend beyond an electoral defeat to an actual real change vis-a-vis racism, real change vis-a-vis climate change.
Yes. In terms of Trump not being the cause, I think it's a kind of subtle interaction in which, of course, the forces of paranoid style in American life, as the historian Hofstetter wrote about, and various forms of right-wing supremacy, white supremacy in general, right-wing violence, these have existed long before Trump, and remnants from the Civil War, as we're seeing played out now. But Trump brings something special as an individual to it. He's not just a symptom, he's also a strong actor in the process, as he brings forth these forces and feeds them with these characteristics of his own self, having to do with solipsism and with grandiose paranoia. So yes, he's both in a way a symptom, but also an added agent of the process as he interacts with these forces of society. And that does create, it deepens the problem for us. Let's assume we get rid of Trump, probably through the election. We then face America that's been damaged. It won't be the end of struggles with reality or struggles for decent government or for institutions that depend upon reality and some sort of humanity. It'll be really an effort to not only undo what he's done and the forces around him have done, but to confront existing patterns in American society that have been so strong. So when he goes, it'll be not the end of our difficulties, but the beginning of a new phase of coping with those difficulties. But God bless that new phase.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, a sentence out of your writing that really nailed something you just said in a very succinct way was, you said, Trump's solecism connects with a sea of mostly right-wing exaggeration, misinformation, conspiracism, falsehood, and lies. That
yes,
is the bath into which he took a cannonball. I assume, I want to talk just a little bit more about a little bit of how we got here vis-a-vis Trump and his followers and the cult-like behavior. I assume that there are self-reinforcing feedback loops with cult thinking. The cult will tell you that anyone who contradicts the cult means you harm. Trump labels anything that contradicts him as fake news. My question was, how do we break that cycle? And yet I wonder if maybe we haven't seen that there are certain realities that can break that cycle.
There's no magic bullet, but I raise questions about our... I assume that we have the possibility for breaking that cycle because we have a long history that has included a democratic openness and aspects of reality that we're deprived of now. And I speak of what I call the protean self or a many-sided self as opposite from the cultic self, which is closed and monolithic. And then I also invoke Václav Havel's
yes.
principle of living in truth. And when that's widely perceived, it really means you start living and insisting upon truth, even when you're under the control of those who are blocking truth and suppressing it. You start living in truth in your own life, in your group, in your politics, whether it's in your home, in your workplace, everywhere, and come to join groups and institutions that insist upon it. Because I don't think we're wired either for cultism or for some perfect harmony in our collective behavior. We have the capacity for autonomy. We can go either way. And I often quote here the experience after I finished a study of Nazi doctors. Friends of mine would say, okay, now you've finished your studying of Nazi doctors. What do you think of humanity right now?
Mm-hmm.
And they expected me to say not very much. But I didn't say that. I said, we can go either way. We can go either way. And that's what I believe. So we have some sense. We have the capacity to influence collectively our own future. I think the political and psychological other groups that are insisting on recognizing reality, fact-checking Trump, of course, but going further and insisting upon the full reality and the true narrative as opposed to the false narratives, those are activities that have to continue in the service of living in truth.
Very good. Let me ask you about a particular thing that has puzzled me, which is that I have kind of always assumed that most people were suspicious, at least, and certainly negatively disposed to liars and cheaters. Going back to, you know, grade school, it seemed to me to lie or to cheat was pretty roundly condemned. Why has Trump been apparently so invulnerable to that distrust?
Yes, it's a very important question. And one of the most troubling matters of our entire struggle has to do with the extent to which Trump has been popular, despite being a liar, a cheater, really having betrayed his country, despite all that. And partly the answer lies in the embrace of his narrative. It's a narrative of revitalization. America used to be great, then bad people or weak people took over, and America got weak. I will come and make it great again. That's what Hitler said in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
That's what other dictators have said in various different countries. So that his followers may not completely, and many don't, believe his lies. Some believe them, some believe part of them. Many ignore them in favor of the narrative. If you embrace the narrative and it feels right and good, you can ignore the lies or dismiss them that accompany the narrative, and the narrative itself takes precedence. and leads to your loyalty and even fanaticism.
Interesting, because as I'm hearing narrative, I'm looking at the note I wrote down here in big capital letters, reality. How does that notion, I mean, and what you've just said, is that if you buy the narrative and you really almost enroll in the narrative, then these little realities of the lies and the things don't matter. What's the clash? What's the clash between narrative and reality?
There was a very well-known psychiatrist and a good friend of mine, Jerome Bruner, who died a few years ago, wrote about narrative psychology and what he called narrative necessity. So there's a kind of narrative necessity, meaning that you need certain points, often untrue ones, to serve the narrative, which takes precedence. So these followers experience a narrative necessity, that is, a requirement that the narrative be reaffirmed, and that being paramount, so that whatever is in it, the lies, the falsehood, the cheating, are forgotten about or ignored in order to serve that narrative. Even in an immediate sense, in connection with the Saturday rally in Tulsa, when people were asked, what about coming here and congregating in such large numbers in a closed auditorium? And they said, aren't you afraid of the virus? And they would give answers like, no, I don't worry about it much. Or, well, the president says it. My president says it's okay, so it's all right. No, I think it's overblown. In other words, the worries about the virus, for at least those people who were interviewed, had to be negated in favor of the sacred narrative, which is at the heart of things and always takes precedence.
Mm-hmm. So a narrative can conform with reality, but it doesn't have to.
That's right. It doesn't have to. Well, there's such a thing as a false narrative, and
sure,
Trump and the Trumpites are full of them.
This leads me to a question that has been on my mind for a while. Soon after the 2016 election, I discovered this quote from Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, most famous for writing The Little Prince. If you want to build a ship, don't drum up the men to gather wood, divide the work, and give orders. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. And my question is, how do we do that in 2020? The passion to return to a simpler past drove enough voters in swing states to decide the 26th presidential election. What's the story? What's the narrative that can generate a future that is as welcome, compelling, inviting as the past that some of these fondly remember?
I think that the Democrats are searching for that kind of narrative and perhaps have found it in part. The narrative being, we need a government that functions well for all of the people and takes on the reality of the COVID-19 virus that confronts us and the reality of racism and oppression, and is even-handed in confronting them. That's what the Democrats are trying to present themselves and their candidate, Joe Biden, as doing. And I think they'll have to extend that or continue with some such narrative that contains those elements.
But as I was listening to you say that, I went, yes, and kind of yes, but, that it's not the vast and endless sea, it's not as exciting. It's not as charismatic.
I think that there are times for charisma and times for steadiness. And I think now it wouldn't be the vast and active and extremely how shall I say, a dangerous sea, but rather the more calm and manageable and welcoming sea as desirable rather than the destructive waves that we've been subjected to.
Okay, that feels right. That given the moment,
yes,
the story doesn't have to be as wild. That steady progress might be, and I think to some extent it almost is a narrative of reality.
Of reality and calmness and capacity to handle very demanding situations. So Saint-Exupéry was right in projecting some larger principle into which everything else goes, the boat that one builds. But yes, the sea can be broiling and full of destructive waves, or it can be calming and welcoming. And it's the latter that I think we're seeking as a country right now. There are subgroups who want transformation, and there has to be a certain amount of transformation and change in society, but it's not a moment for intense revolution so much as for achieving some kind of equality and overcoming the most extreme problems in the society that have to do with unreality and racism and climate and the dangerous virus.
Right. What I just heard in what you were saying is the scale and boldness of the challenges we face. There's plenty of grandness in the challenges, and so just to come and meet them is a worthy call.
To meet them and handle them,
yeah,
with ability and with sensitivity to the needs of the American people, that would be doing a lot. And I think that, you know, when we say that Trump has been getting away with a lot, of course he has, but I think that his lies and his egregious behavior are not simply Teflon that washes off, but they have accrued in the minds of Americans now, especially in recent months and weeks. They build in people's minds a profound need for interrupting the incapacity of this president and his destructive behavior and replace it with its opposite.
Yeah. We've got to end the conversation, but just the phrase I remembered there was one of Trump's closing arguments was, "What have you got to lose?" And the events of the last few months have reminded people what they have to lose, that the election of Trump in a way was an indulgence from a comfortable time.
Yes, and we have a lot more to lose now, and we have a lot we can gain by struggling toward the embrace of factual and immediate reality, which is so central to all we have to do.
Very good. So again, Robert J. Lifton's most recent books are Losing Reality and The Climate Swerve, and you can learn more at robertjlifton.com. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or a world that just might work. All one word, aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, plus 8 to 10 articles each week I choose to flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform Podcast on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and most other podcast sites. And you'll find years of podcasts at my site or at those. Listen anytime, anywhere. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to George Vapsilopoulos at Progressive Voices. And most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Finally, thank you, Robert J. Lifton, and keep up your good work.
Thank you.